This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and an unexpected but nonetheless very special guest, Sue Bevan. Welcome, Sue.
Lovely to be here, Joni.
Hi. And our original guest, Jean Bartram, will be coming back at a later date. But today, Sue's got so much to fill the show with. I think we've got enough for about 3 hours. So we're going to try and fit in as much as possible. Because you're a writer, performer, poet, a lady of words.
Yes, I am. Yeah. I write plays. I've written a memoir. I write short stories, poems, yeah.
So love words. And I think I know you're artist in residence at Ride School with Upper Chine.
I am, yes. And that's wonderful to be working with young people.
How did that come about?
Well, they appointed I'm their first artist in residence. And I met with the headmaster and he was exploring how to bring the arts into school. And explored this idea of an artist in residence. He knows my work previously. He's seen me work in schools. He's seen my theatre performances and so on. He said, for the first artist in residence, I needed to be somebody who understands schools, understands how to work with young people and the staff, but also has the artistic credentials. Would you come and do it?
Absolutely.
And it's that thing of balancing. He wanted someone who would come in and stimulate the artistic activity without putting extra pressure on staff who are already stretched. We know how teachers are.
Absolutely.
And it's been a real privilege, actually.
So I have a vision, obviously completely wrong, of you as artist in residence, sort of wafting down the hallowed corridors of Ride School, draped in velvet, mainly.
Of course, every day.
Yes. glasses perched on the end of your nose, reciting poetry as you go.
It doesn't tend to be like that, because nobody would hear it. They'd all be rushing off to lessons and lunch and break and the loo and things. So no, it doesn't work like that. It's been really varied. I mean, the thing that I probably relate most is working with the tiny ones who are preschool. So we're talking about 4-year-olds upwards, and I've not worked with that age group before. I'm a mum, so, you know.
Yes, and you know how they work.
Yeah, and I was a very hands-on mum who loved doing things for groups of children. But I've never officially worked with that age group. And in the first term that I was there, they had an Alice in Wonderland week. So I dressed up as the White Rabbit, hired a costume, got the makeup on, and went in and played a whole load of what are effectively theatre games with the children. And I loved it, and they loved it. But even now, we're now 12 months on, and when I pass some of those children, they still call, White Rabbit, White Rabbit.
Oh,
and there is still one child who will remain nameless, who's still promising me, I'm going to bring you 2 carrots, White Rabbit. 2. And she shows me 2 fingers. 2 carrots. And then one day she said, I've got my own rabbit now. I don't think I can bring you those carrots because he eats a lot of them.
Oh, so that's that passage
gorgeous.
Of time, isn't it? So
it
kind of that gorgeous. growing up and moving on, isn't it?
And then I'm working with older students on a performance or just exploring their own creativity within theatre. So either with a script or without a script and devising new pieces, running writing workshops. I did my first art installation there where they did what's called an identity tapestry. I could come back to that if you want to know about that.
Yeah.
And introduced an acoustic jazz and poetry evening. So I'm trying to work across the arts. It's not just about creative writing and theatre.
That's a huge role, isn't it?
It is a huge role, yeah. But it's also one in which I'm really given a blank page. And if I come in with an exciting idea, the great thing is the head and the deputy head, who's my kind of line manager, are both there saying, that's a brilliant idea. Come back in a couple of days and tell us how it's going to work.
Fantastic.
And then it happens.
Oh,
and the children are fantastic too.
Equally, we know the blank page, as you described it, can be the most liberating thing. It can almost act in the opposite way and be the thing that shuts you down and terrifies
absolutely.
You.
Oh, absolutely, totally. Yeah. As a writer, especially. So I work with the children, and I've worked with some of the teachers, parents, other adults in the community to look at that blank page thing, actually, and bring in exercises. I don't know if you do this when you're writing, but there are particular exercises to try and stimulate people.
Yes, open it up for them, and so it's not that terrifying thing.
Yeah.
Yes, they're staring down at with nothing. Yes, no, I work with a lot of those, and I run workshops as well, so I know exactly that kind of thing. And people want you to almost give them a blueprint, but it's not about that, is it? It's about opening up your mind to different suggestions.
And I'm fascinated, I don't know how you work when you're writing, but I'm fascinated by how some writers will say, I've got a massive spreadsheet and I know it's going to have 20 chapters, and I write down what's going to happen in each, and then I start working on the logistics. I'll have mind maps and all kinds of diagrams of things, and then I fit the writing into that. And then others say, I simply start writing.
Yeah, so it's. I think it's so individual, isn't it, the whole process? And I think to want to conform or think you need to conform to a set way is wrong.
Yeah.
The only right thing to do is that you do it your way and what works for you.
And that you write. And maybe explore different things. I went to a talk over at Southampton, at the Nuffield. They've got a great thing running there called Lab, and it's nurturing new talent. And they had a well-established prize-winning writer there who was talking about the fact that he begins writing a play. He knows the topic he's going to write on. So if it's, for instance, about, let's say, migrants, he reads and reads and reads for 2 weeks, just 2 weeks solid reading. And then he comes back and has an idea of, okay, these are the characters I think I'm working with, this is the plot I'm working with, and just begins to write. But once he's written the first draft, he then comes back and takes out whole chunks of plot and says, don't need that, don't need that, this scene is written, we can do that. And then he comes back and takes out little sections, then he comes back and takes out sentences, and then finally he comes back and takes out words. So he does this repeatedly, but basically he's just the whole time sharpening, yes. Sharpening.
So it's research at the beginning, obviously, reading about his subject, and then constant editing process, which is the way to work, isn't it?
Yes. But different ways of editing. And here's the whole thing of edit big and then down to the small.
Yes, I think there's a lot of sense in that. Yeah. But talking of new talent, I know you've got a show, an audience with Sheryl, I receives rave reviews, and you've had a number of gigs with that on the island, haven't you?
Yes, at Key Arts. The first one I did was at the school, at Ride School, and at Ventnor Exchange. So I've done several nights across.
So tell us about it, because I'm intrigued. Because there's a picture of you on the poster, isn't there? Is it a black wig and glasses? And a green
chiffon dress. Yes. It's a vintage dress, beautiful dress.
And that's a really sparky picture. So tell us about the show.
Well, it's semi-autobiographical. So it starts with my real life, but I'm not performing it. The character I perform is called Sheryl, who grew up in the Welsh Valleys like me. So she's a cross between, I would say, kind of Dame Edna Everidge and Shirley Bassey and maybe Graham Norton or something.
I have to see.
That's
brilliant.
She is barking mad. She's totally barking mad. And it begins with a lot of comedy. So I welcome the people in and get to know them as they come through the door a little, and then start to tell them my story about growing up in the Welsh Valleys. And there's a lot of humour involved in that, because it was a very tight-knit community.
And what time was spent when we took in 56?
Well, so I was born in 56. So until I was four, we lived with my granny in a small rented miners' terraced house. And that was me and my brother and sister, who were 6 and 7 years older than me. So I was it was like being an only child. And my parents, who were working in a factory and driving a bus. So my mum in the factory, my dad driving the bus. And so I rarely saw them. It was our granny who raised us.
And did your granny have any... did she have any aspirations to be a writer herself?
No.
Was she artistic?
She sang beautifully. When we go on the chapel outing in the summer to Barry Island, or Aberavon sometimes, they would always shout, "Come on, Mrs. Smith, you know, give us a song," and she would be the one to start singing. But no, she was, she'd always just wanted to be a wife and mother, but she lost her husband quite young, and she was crippled. She had a disease called Paget's disease, which bows, it destroys the bone. So it bows legs,
right,
and bows the spine. And so she stood no higher than maybe sort of 4'6" or something by the time she was bent over. The most amazing nurturer and carer in the world.
So there she was with this sort of suffering, yet she managed to raise you and instill something very special in you.
It's interesting. I mean, I tell you, growing up in that household, so she had a great friend, Mrs. Connelly, who was a blind Irish lady who lived down the road, white hair, flat on her head, you know, and kind of white eyes behind these dark glasses, and she walked with a white stick with her black guide dog, and they would sit in front of the open fire for hours, the two of them, watching for faces in the burning embers. But Mrs. Connelly was a medium,
right,
so she would say to my gran, so I'm now 4 years old, okay, in the kitchen,
I'm picturing you,
and she is saying, well, Ruth, she was Irish, but she had the Welsh accent. Well, Ruth, your Tom is behind you right now, and he's saying, don't worry about Jack. Jack's going to be fine. He's not going to stay married to that woman very long. And, you know, so I'm looking for my dead grandfather behind my gran, who I never knew. I've no idea what he looks like. But I know there's this dead guy there in the room with us. And...
But did you feel very safe?
I felt very safe. You know, she and I would climb the stairs to bed. I slept in a huge bed with her. We'd climb the stairs in moving shadows because we'd go up by candlelight. There wasn't a switch at the top and bottom. So, you know, her shadow on the wall was enormous. And then we'd get into bed together and we'd make shadow animals on the walls. Yeah. And she'd read to me. So she taught me. I could read before I went to school. She'd read, you know, all the nursery rhymes and all the folk tales with her finger following the words on the page and my eyes following her finger. So I just learned by osmosis, I suppose, to read. And she was just always full of stories of people in the family and things that had happened to my grand. She'd talk about my granddad coming back from the allotment, you know, with a chicken hanging dead in his hand and plucking it at the table. So it was very, it was a rich visual.
I was just going to say she was painting so many pictures for you, wasn't she? And stimulating your imagination.
And encouraging me to do. So, I mean, I have such strong memories of, there were two rooms in the house. Well, there were three. At the back, where we spent most of our time, was the kitchen with an open fire and a kettle constantly on. And then next to that was the middle room where we sort of lived. And then the parlour, which we never used.
That was for best, I guess.
That was for best. And you couldn't even say for Sundays or Christmas. Even that wasn't
best enough
to be in. So between the kitchen, where there was a step down, and the middle room was a big velvet or brocade, maybe, curtain to keep one room warm at a time.
That's right, yes.
And that was my stage. So I'd be in the middle room, I'd open that curtain, age 4, 5, 6, and I would be dressed in, you know, my grandfather's old clothes, and I'd have Mrs. Connelly's walking stick as my cane, and somehow there was a top hat, but I've no idea why. And she taught me all these things like Tiptoe in the Tulips and all the war songs.
All the classics.
Absolute classics. So I'd devise a little dance. I'd do it for Mrs. Connelly, who was blind and couldn't see the dance, thank God. And then, you know, just do this song and dance number for the two of them. And that would be my whole day's play, really, was getting this whole thing ready, getting the costume ready, do the show, take the bow. I didn't quite get to do the interviews with them, but...
So was the audience always the two of them?
Just the two of them. Who, of course, were adoring, yes, as grannies always will be if somebody puts a show on.
And did you vary the content of the show?
All sorts of things. So I'd sometimes tell them a story and make those up, or recite a poem that we'd been doing in school, or sing them a hymn that we'd sung week after week after week endlessly in assembly at school. Anything, just anything to entertain them.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. Do you think some of that was triggered by dare I use the word, boredom?
I don't think that... Do you know, it's funny, isn't it? We talk about being bored. The alternative was to be doing things like colouring things, drawing things.
So it was something creative.
Yeah, or I'd be outside playing with the other kids and we'd make mud pies in the garden, or we'd be playing with a whip and top in the street. I looked for one of these the other day and I don't even know if they exist anymore.
I don't think they do.
Skipping ropes. And then when I was older, sort of 10 and 11, we used to string together the elastic bands. Do you remember that?
Yes,
and
yes,
you'd
yes.
have them between your feet.
Cat's cradle.
And do a kind of jumping game
skipping.
In and out.
Was it called something skipping, wasn't it?
French skipping. Is that what it was?
Yeah, and you make a cat's cradle.
Yeah.
Some girls were really good at it and could do all sorts of magical things with their feet, which I could never do. But I've mentioned the word boredom because I don't think we allow our children these days to become bored. We put a tablet in front of them, don't we? Or we sit them in front of the TV, some sort of screen which entertains them.
Yes.
And they're not required to make their own entertainment, perhaps in the way we were.
Yeah. It so-called frees us up, doesn't it? But I think, you know, I remember my son when he was about four.
This is Benjamin.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He was four or five when we were driving down to my family who relocated down to Plymouth. And we'd been driving along for some time and he had... he didn't then have something with headphones, but he used to play tapes in the car, you know, children's stories or music or whatever. Or he'd be doing a bit of a drawing, but that tended to make him travel sick. So, and he'd been just gazing out of the window for like an hour, not a word, said nothing, and all I could think was, well, he's trying not to be travel sick. So I said, are you all right, sweetheart? Yes, thank you. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm doing my favorite thing. And I said, what's that? He said, I'm watching a film in my head.
Wow.
So he was just imagining some kind of story and was could just see it and was just watching it. And at that moment, I thought, okay, he's doing all right.
He's going to be fine.
Well, you always hope. You never know, do you, what's around
the
corner.
So has he gone on to do something very creative now?
Yeah, he has. He is. He went to Cambridge and did a degree in history, and we thought he'd be an academic. That seemed to be his field. But he discovered a voice while he was there, so he's now doing a master's in performance studies at the Royal Academy of Music. So he's aiming to be an opera singer. Oh. And came down and did a lovely masterclass with some of the students from the school and another who wasn't, and a recital in Ryde last Friday.
Oh, that must have been a lovely moment.
Yeah. He's doing a lot of singing. He was a choral scholar at Norwich Cathedral for a couple of years in between university and doing this, but singing is his passion.
Do you sing in show?
I sing a little bit of one song.
And so
it's not a wannabe show. It's about, the show's about a woman's search for connection in a kind of shifting landscape, really.
But it's much lighter. That makes it sound quite heavy, but it's very entertaining. It's very funny.
It's got both.
This deeper level, hasn't it?
I call it tragic comedy because it's based on my own life. But then it goes. So it's not. I'm not performing my own life. I think there's a great field of theatre that does that, but that's not what I'm doing in this. The character I play tells the real story of growing up as I did, living with Granny. And then moving away from there when I was five and moving into a very dysfunctional family, really, household. My parents fought the whole time.
So you were wrenched away from this lovely, warm, cosy, creative atmosphere where you were allowed to shine.
Yeah, that was very safe. And suddenly we had situations where my mother would be talking to my father through me.
Oh, no.
You know, that whole thing. So she'd send him to Coventry.
How old were you?
Well, from the age of five onwards, really, until I went to university.
That sounds hideous.
Horrendous. You know, tell your father his dinner's ready. Dad, your dinner's ready. Tell your mother I heard her. He says he heard you, Mum. We're all in the same room.
Yes.
You know?
You're just the mouthpiece.
And I'm just the mouthpiece. And it was horrendous. There were a lot of... there was no violence, but it was an emotionally really damaging place to be.
Sounds very tense.
Yeah. So I went off looking for love elsewhere. And I found boys. And by the time I was 15, I was a mother. But the decision was made on my behalf that the child would be adopted. And so I was sent away to have her secretly, sent 300 miles away, 200 miles. And I had her for 8 days in hospital and then handed her over to a social worker who took over the process of the adoption.
I can't imagine how that must have made you feel.
I can't. I mean, there aren't words for it, really.
Did you name her?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I called her Alison, but her adopted parents give children new names, don't they?
Yes.
So, and it was in those days, adoption was different from today. So, if a child was adopted, when you signed the papers, that was it forever. Neither side would ever be allowed access to the papers. So not only could I not find her, she would never be able to find me.
That seems so wrong.
And so you never know if your child is alive or dead. And and then I had to go back 200 miles to school and pretend it had never happened.
And did the other children know what had happened?
I didn't know that they did, but they did.
And the teachers, so everybody was aware.
Yeah, but I had no idea that anyone knew.
And of course, nowadays, it's far more common, I imagine, than it was back then.
Yeah.
And did you feel stigmatised?
It's interesting, actually. I don't think so. I don't think so. Do you know, when I think about that time of returning to school, I have very few memories of the next year or so. I think I was just in shock.
You must have been. And do you think you were so consumed with thinking about Alison?
Yeah. And I've discovered recently that it's not uncommon to suffer post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, of course it must
and
be.
And I look back and I think, oh, that's why I did that, and that's why that was happening. I did a lot of reading about it. And then I wrote, I went through infertility treatment then for years, trying to conceive again. I struggled to have another child. But when I fell pregnant when I was directing a play without realising it and had a miscarriage. So it was just, you know, a trauma. It was loss after loss.
Yes.
After
the worst,
being denied a child in every way, really.
Worst loss for a woman, I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dreadful. And how old were you when you had Benjamin?
I was 37.
So in a very different place.
Very different place. But that was the most extraordinary... That was just extraordinary, really, because I had written a play. So when I had the miscarriage, which was about a year and a half before I had Ben, that I ended up in hospital and... the counsellor there said to me, look, you're a writer, write this stuff, just write out your feelings, you know, so it can be very therapeutic. And I was running a theatre company at the time, so I did. I wrote a play called Half a Million Women, because half a million women in the UK had lost their children to adoption. And it was, again, the start was entirely autobiographical. It was about being 15, falling pregnant, having a child, losing the child to adoption, very raw. I mean, it was just straight on the page. Emotions, yes. Straight on the page. And then the second half of the play was three birth mothers who'd lost their children at different times, so very different ages. One in her early 20s, me in my mid-30s, and another one in her 60s, telling their stories of their own experience. And while we were directing this, while I was writing it, I fell pregnant with Ben. And my theatre company put the play on, and we, again, you know, I had no idea if my daughter was alive or dead, but the only time we could get a theatre space to perform this play about her birth loss and how it felt to be at my age, wondering if your daughter was even still out there. The only time we could get to put it on was the days running up to her 21st birthday. And the last show was on her 21st birthday.
Goodness.
I was 7 months pregnant with the first child I would next have.
But the fact that you fell pregnant at that time with Benjamin just seems so much magic around
it. Yeah.
And so much meant to be. So I'd like to hear so much more from you, Sue, after the break, because I just find this absolutely wonderful and fascinating. So thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Not at all.
Okay, we'll be back with more from Sue Bevan after the break. Thank you.
Stay social and get in touch. It's /Vectis Radio on Facebook. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my special guest, Sue Bevan. Welcome back, Sue.
Hi again.
Just before the break, we were talking about your one-woman show, An Audience with Sheryl, that you've done here on the island. I think you're planning a UK tour coming up.
Yeah.
That sounds very exciting, and I've got to see it now. I've got to see it. And just before the break, we got to a very emotional part where you were saying that you fell pregnant while you were rehearsing the show with your son, Benjamin. And was it the final rehearsal was on your daughter's...
No, the final show was on my daughter's...
21st.
My lost daughter's 21st birthday.
Your adopted daughter's 21st birthday. Yeah. So I can't imagine how that made you feel. How did it make you feel?
Well, the doing of the show in itself was emotional because we began it with an empty stage... Me very heavily 7 months pregnant, sitting in a rocking chair in a spotlight, singing a cappella, Mockingbird. You know that song?
Yes,
yes. Little baby,
yes.
Don't say a word. So, and then the lights went down and I walked from there to the front row. And then the play unfolded. So I was trying to say, this is my story. It is my story. So in any case, it was emotional, and the women had cried buckets in rehearsals. But I came home from one of the dress rehearsals, and my husband said, I think you'd better sit down. And my first thought was, brilliant, we've got the Arts Council funding I've applied for. We can become a big theatre company and go on tour. And I said, is it the Arts Council? He said, just sit down. Well, have we got the money? Just sit down. And then he told me my daughter was looking for me.
Wow.
And she had been back to South Wales, where I lived when she was when I was pregnant with her, and that she'd gone to see the local vicar and tried to. She had the address of where I lived. She'd gone to try and find people who might know me. None of my family lived there anymore, so she was never going to find me that way. But she then went to the local paper to put in an ad saying, does anyone know this person?
Yes.
But they were so interested that they ran a front page story. Does anyone know Helen's mother? With my name, as I was when I was 15, and where I lived, and, you know, all kinds of... my mother would have... Well, she'd have killed me if she'd known.
I was going to say, that was a very invasive
way. Yeah, it was a bad decision on their part.
It wasn't really their decision to make.
No, but they made it. And it was fortunate for me because what we ended up doing was meeting for the first time on her 21st birthday and sitting in the front row of the theatre and watching the play unfold about me discovering I was pregnant, her birth, and how it felt to be 37 and wonder if your child is still alive. So all the questions she had in the afternoon of her birthday when we met, did you ever think about me on my birthday? I just had to say, you just need to wait and see the show. Yes, I did. You'll find out tonight.
So you had this ready-made package of answers, in a way, by complete coincidence.
Absolute coincidence that she...
all laid out for her
came
to
that
see.
Night, yeah.
How did she react to receiving that kind of information in that way?
We were both very emotional. You know, I think we were both... It was like... Well, it's funny. I described it at the time, for me, as having a limb sewn back on. I felt that I'd lost something fundamental of me, which I had, and that it had been sewn back on. Whatever it was, I felt whole, really. For her, she said she felt all the answers to all the questions were there, and I was happy to tell her, you know, everything that I could about how it was for me and how it felt to have her back in my life. It was, and we had a honeymoon period. It was like a love affair, really, for some time.
Because this show is a tribute, isn't it? To Alison.
Yeah.
And your daughter. And to even the fact that you had done that must have spoken volumes to her, that that's how much you thought of her, that's how much the whole thing had affected you.
An event like that defines who you are. You know, so now I'm 60 years old, just had my 60th birthday recently, and I am still now performing in my current show, An Audience with Cheryl, a story about a woman looking for connection. And there are elements in it that are about the birth of my daughter. It's about someone who's... relationships and landscape are shifting all the time, and she's looking for some solid ground. And although there's a lot of comedy in the piece, I call it a tragic comedy. And I've taken it into schools and done workshops, and as part of their sex education. And what I say is, why am I at my age? Why is this 60-year-old woman performing still something that happened to me at 15? Because the consequences of finding yourself pregnant at 15 do not go away. Whatever choice you make,
that's right,
you're left with consequences. And actually, it's very powerful because students listen to me because they know I'm not didactic. I'm not lecturing. I'm not, you know, standing on a high horse and saying they should not be doing this, that or the other. I'm talking about the real life consequences of what they do.
Yes.
And that, so, you know, the writing I do, whatever it is I think all my work so far, because I'm now working on a couple of other plays, one to do with, sounds heavy, child sexual exploitation, right, and another one to do with euthanasia. But they both have a lot of comedy in them. But my work is about women. And I was going to say
it's about real life, isn't it?
It's about real life,
these difficult subjects.
Yeah.
But they're euthanasia, life and death in one go.
Yeah.
They're
about love.
And in those moments, we always find the funny, because you have to, don't you?
You have
that's
to,
how it
absolutely,
works.
Yeah, yeah.
But can I just go back to An Audience with Cheryl and your daughter? I'm picturing you both sitting there watching this.
Yeah, the one we were watching was Half a Million Women, which was the earlier play, but yeah.
It must have, like I say, the fact that you had put all this energy and work into... At the time, you hadn't been in a position where you were able to bring her up, but you had brought a play to life about that was all constructed around and about her and your feelings for her. And what a fantastic tribute. Did she see it as a wonderful tribute, or was she angry with you? Was she pleased? How did she feel?
She saw it as that. I think the whole thing of birth mothers meeting their children is complex.
Very complex.
It's interesting. This morning on Desert Island Discs, Jackie Kay was on, who's written, you know, I mean, she's I can't remember the name of the title, but it's the equivalent of National Poet of Scot- Scotland, and she's written this piece, The Adoption Papers, because she was adopted, and it tells the story from three angles: the birth mother, the child, and the adoptive mother. And she was saying, she talks very movingly about the point at which she met her birth mother, and her birth mother not being able to connect. She said I couldn't ask any questions because she just talked the whole time to fill the space. And it's a complicated one.
I know sometimes that it can get even more complicated, can't it, when it's the mother perhaps and a son meeting, because they haven't had that close cuddling relationship, and then they meet and it's like meeting the flip side of the same coin.
Yeah.
There can be the wrong type of attraction.
Yeah.
But that's quite a common phenomenon, isn't it?
Yes,
Birth parents meeting adopted children when they're adults.
And therefore, keeping a distance between them because it doesn't feel right.
Yes.
So I think there are, you know, you're meeting, I had an 8-day-year-old child taken away, and I met a 21-year-old woman.
Of course.
And all of that, as you say, shared history is missing. But on the other hand, when I look in her eyes, I see her father's eyes. And when I look at her nose and her mouth, I see me. And the moment I saw her, when we were waiting for her to arrive on her birthday, I kept watching people passing the window, you know, is that her? And
so you had no idea what she looked like?
No, none at all. No, nothing. And then a young woman passed with a young man, and I said, that's her. It was immediate. I could see both her father and me.
And does she have any contact with her father?
No. She met him once. He wasn't interested. I've not been in touch with him since I was a teenager. He wasn't interested, and she felt she could do without that. And I think that's a wise decision sometimes for people to say, this is, you know, we can dream. This is not going to be the dream relationship. We live in the real world.
Yes, I know.
And you have to work with the real world.
I know someone who met their birth mother when they were 18, and he wanted very much to meet his father.
Yeah.
But she wouldn't put him in contact.
No.
For whatever reason.
Yes.
And I think there were more her reasons than she wouldn't allow him that choice.
Yes.
So I think that brought out its own problems as well.
It's massively, massively complicated.
Indeed.
So complicated. Yeah.
But, and how's things now?
It's been a tricky 20 odd years, really. So that's the only area that I don't talk about, because that involves where she currently is and where I currently am. And I think to do that without her permission to talk about it is not fair.
Yeah.
But I'll just come back to that phrase. It's not easy. It's not easy.
No. But it's lovely that you've created this wonderful piece of work that I know audiences rave about.
Yeah.
And can connect with. And they may not share any of those experiences.
No, not at all.
I think, you know, we're all human, we're all on this planet together, so there's lots of connections in other ways that we all have, aren't there?
There are universals, like love and loss and longing and, you know, the funny side of things. There are universals in all of those that people can tap into. You don't have to have experienced everything that's in a play or something on TV to relate to it and be moved by it.
No, it's just that common human experience, isn't it? And have that empathy with somebody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you think, it's never happened to me, but I can get there. I can imagine how that would have been.
Yeah.
And I know not only with your own work, but you have recently brought some amazing work to the Key Arts and Venture Exchange.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, I was invited to take an audience with Sheryl, my current show, down to South Africa. Sorry, I'm struggling with a cold at the moment. But to the Women Playwrights International Conference. It's held every 3 years, and women from all over the world involved in theatre meet there. And they invited five shows that weren't African. The focus was on Africa, but they invited five shows that weren't. And so I took the only British show. I took my show. Manira Hashimi, who I'll explain in a moment, it's complex, brought her solo show. So I saw it in South Africa and thought, this has to be seen in the UK. Absolutely has to be seen in the UK. Should be seen everywhere. And since last summer, when I first saw it, and now, it's been to India and the States and Canada and all, you know, all over.
And is this The Stars?
It's called The Stars. It's a one-woman show that tells the story. So Manira is... Her parents were Afghan... still are. They are Afghans who left Afghanistan as refugees to Iran when Afghanistan was invaded in the 80s. When Iran got invaded, they moved back to Afghanistan, and Manira had now been born along with her brother, and they moved back home to Afghanistan. So she's an Iranian-born Afghan who makes theatre telling women's lives. And 4 years ago she was performing in Sweden, a show called Women Under the Burqa, and she was threatened with stoning when she, if she were to go back to Afghanistan.
Right.
And so she performs this amazing storytelling with Afghan dance and song, incredibly powerful. And she did it at Wright School for the UK premiere, and then Key Arts and Ventnor Exchange.
And so what did they make of that? So the people saw it at Wright and the parents?
Extraordinary response. Absolutely extraordinary response. I've got, you know, some people have written to me. Others have sent postcards and all, just extraordinary. I did say to some of the students, was that a bit heavy? Was that, you know... Do you think that was appropriate for your age group? These students were 15. And they said, absolutely not. This is exactly what we should be seeing. You know, it's real stories of lives way beyond our experience.
Exactly, but very relevant.
And very dramatic and beautifully performed. Yeah, and very relevant, totally.
And that does that incorporate dance as well?
It does, yeah. Beautiful, traditional Afghan dance.
And poetry?
Well, the writing is like poetry, right, at times. At the end, she says she's having struggled with herself about whether she should run away and stop writing because her life literally is at risk. You know, theatre for her is a matter of life and death. And she does this beautiful piece that is stay and look into the eyes of the man who raped and murdered your child because she was the seventh and he would go to paradise if he killed seven children. Mm. Stay and face the person who did this. Stay and stand up for this. Stay and say this. And it's an extraordinary... So it's poetry. The writing is poetry. And the performance is, oh, just amazing. Amazing.
And is... Because there seems some parallels with your themes as well. Mm. Is there some, would there ever be a collaboration between you two?
We're talking about, so I always have too many projects on the go. And one of them is a piece called Lipstick and Underwear, which is the story of, telling the story of women who have survived war situations. And one of them talked about having been put in a rape camp in Bosnia, and when she was brought out of it and reunited with her family, they asked what she wanted, and she said lipstick, and they said anything else, and she said silk underwear. And they said why, and she said, because when they come to do this to me again, I want them to see me as a whole woman who still respects who she is.
Goodness me.
So Manira is writing a piece that could be woven into that, so we're looking at maybe collaborating on that, yes.
That's very powerful, isn't it?
I think power, theatre has the power to really connect with people, and tell their stories.
So where is Munira currently performing Stars?
She's gone back to Sweden. She was only here for the Isle of Wight tour. We did it in the Houses of Parliament as well. We did it in the Commons. We took it up there and performed it there. Very well. We were aiming it at the British Afghan population who came, which was great. So we now have... I'm now looking at the possibility of bringing her back and doing a national UK tour. That was just a tour of the island with the Commons thrown in. So she may be back. You have to watch that space for this.
Did you get funding then for that?
We got Arts Council funding. My first attempt at applying, and
I gather it's an absolute nightmare.
It is a total. It took me weeks. But clearly, they like the work. They feel they want to support theatre coming here, and that for me is great because I'd love to stay on the island when my contract ends in August next year. But I have to find a role. So people have to come and see my work and the Arts Council have to support it.
Is this your contract at Ryde School?
It's a fixed term contract, and we're all quite clear about that and that it's the right thing to do. So I finish there in August, and then I have to consider whether I stay on the Isle of Wight forever and make theatre here and bring theatre in from elsewhere.
Where do you think your heart is now, Sue?
I love the island.
So it's no longer in the Welsh Valleys.
It's a little part of my heart will always be there. You know, that's where I was born and raised, and I feel very, and I'm Welsh for sure. But I love this island.
It gets under your skin, doesn't it?
There's something of the Welsh Valleys here, the sense of community, the sense of people having a strong identity connected with the land. Yeah, and there's room for some more people making brilliant professional theatre here, I think.
Yes.
Just need to bring the audience out of the woodwork a bit.
Yes, I think that is special. But maybe on these dark nights when there's nothing else going on, perhaps it is a lovely thing for them to look forward to and do.
Yeah.
So perhaps we need to start offering more stuff for them to encourage them to come out and enjoy it and see what's on offer.
Yes.
Well, it's been an absolute joy talking to you, and I'd love you to come back because I know there's so much more that you've got to say.
I'd love to come back. It's been a real pleasure.
And we want to hear your poems next time because we've just run out of time. But you have been wonderful, and I hope you've all enjoyed listening to Sue as much as I've enjoyed talking to her. And please listen again next week when I've got poet and celebrant Jenny Law as my special guest. In the meantime, have a wonderful, safe, happy week, and speak to you very soon. Take care. Bye-bye now. www.vectusradio.com